Hey, I've got an idea for you. How about saving some money when you purchase the wines that you already like? To help you do that, we here at the podcast have teamed up with the excellent folks at Crush Wine and Spirits in Manhattan to offer you wines we talk about on the show at a discount. All you have to do is check crushwineco.com, that's crushwineco.com, for the latest offer and use the discount code IDTT for me. That's IDTTFORME to get your special price as a listener of this show. You'll be drinking well with wines you are knowledgeable about, you'll be saving money, and you'll be helping out the show. Check out crushwineco.com and make your own voice heard. I'll drink to that, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today.
Are you guys ready to get warmed up? Because I am.
The famous vineyard Romani Conti was first sold under that name in the 1790s during the French Revolution, when the vineyard was seized from nobility and auctioned off. Before that, it was known as La Romanée. And before that, it had a different name, Croix de Cloux, when it was tended by monks from the Priory of Saint-Vivant. In 1760, the La Romanée vineyard was sold to Louis-François de Bourbon, the Prince de Conti. Since then, the vineyard has been called Romani Conti. But how did Louis-François become interested in the property? Who was he, and how did he influence the vineyard's social clout? Louis-François was born the great-grandson of Louis XIV. His convivial and extravagant nature was apparent from his teenage years, and he experienced a successful military career, the confidence of King Louis XV, and an active social life at his Parisian palace, where he rubbed shoulders with Mozart and Rousseau. He purchased the vineyard for 8,000 livres, a currency introduced by Charlemagne and used for about 1,000 years. 1 livre was supposed to equal 1 pound of silver, so the Prince de Conti bought the vineyard for an equivalent of 8,000 pounds of silver, which in today's money would be something close to $2 million. A hefty sum, but a drop in the bucket considering he had just gotten 1 million livres as a dowry when his son married the year before. But why was the vineyard so expensive? Well, even back then, La Romanée was considered a great vineyard, and wines from there carried one of the highest market prices. When it went up for sale, lots of elite people wanted it, including Louis XV's mistress, Madame Pompadour. But Louis-François won the bidding. Once in his possession, he added the name Conti to the vineyard and had all the wine diverted to his Parisian palace for personal consumption for himself and his palace guests. Upon Louis-François's death, his son, Louis-François Joseph, took over and continued much like his father. But during the French Revolution, Louis-François Joseph was arrested, stripped of his possessions, jailed, then released, and then banished to Barcelona. The Romani Conti vineyard was auctioned off, and Prince Louis-François Joseph died a poor man in Spain. With him died the Prince of Conti title. The history of the Romani Conti vineyard echoes the very history of Burgundy. Once made for purely religious and sacramental reasons, it then entered a capitalistic world for a time, before it was claimed by royalty. In a way, Louis-François's decision to take the wine off the market and keep it for himself parallels the excesses of the nobility that sparked the French Revolution. The vineyard was reappropriated and became a part of the free market once again. Though the land has been used to make religious, secular, and royal wine, today it seems to have struck a nice balance in the global market. And though it's no longer made for sacramental purposes, most will tell you that drinking it is still a religious experience.
$7.50. Which is very simply the greatest resource for wholesale wine buyers on the planet, is available in many states, very probably yours. Are you a buyer in Alabama, California, Colorado, Connecticut, D.C., Delaware, Florida, Georgia, Illinois, Massachusetts, Maryland, North Carolina, South Carolina, that's right, both Carolinas, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, Texas, or Virginia? Then 750 is for you. It will help you organize. It will help you sort. It will help you find what you need, and it will save you time. 750 has what you need to do your work better. Check out 750.com. There are so many powerful features, you'll start to wonder how you ever got along without it. 750.com. Find today what you'll want to drink tomorrow.
Aubert de Villain of DRC on the show today. Hello, sir. How are you?
I am fine. And I like the weather you have today in New York. It's cold and dry weather. I would love to take it back to Burgundy.
Well, it might be a different kind of wine then, you know.
No, because we have had a very mild and rainy winter for the moment, and we need cold to kill the bugs, and also the vines like to have a normal season. And for the moment, the season has been too mild.
When did you first find yourself in Burgundy? Were you born there, or did you move from another place?
No, I wasn't born there. I was born in the north of France, just before the war, in 1939. And later, my parents went to live in Moulins, which is in the center of France, about 100 miles from Burgundy. And it's only when I was 25 that I went to Burgundy. I arrived as a member of a family who had been owners in Burgundy for several generations, but myself, newcomer.
And what was your family like?
My family is a family of people who were on one side, on the French side, there were people, half military people and half peasants, people cultivating the land, the earth in L'Allier, in southern France. And so a very traditional old French family. And on the other side, on my mother's side, there were Russians who escaped from Russia in 1918. And so very different background. But my mother left Russia with her parents when she was very young, 9 years old in 1918, was a refugee with her parents in England, and met my father in the 30s, married him, and spent all her life then without moving from Moulins in L'Allier. So it's interesting because it's somebody who went through the history of Europe, through some of the most difficult parts, the Russian Revolution, Second World War, and then had a very quiet life with six children in this small town of Moulins.
And what was childhood like, you know, post-war France?
You know, it's difficult because I don't have real memories. My father was a prisoner during the Second World War for almost 5 years. I was born on the 2nd of August of 1939. He went to war on the 5th of September of the same year, 1939, and came back in 1944. So I knew him only when I was already almost five years old child.
So you were one of the youngest children then?
The oldest.
You were the oldest child?
The oldest, yes.
So when he came back, they had several more children right away?
When he came back, they had five children in 7 years. Good job. They worked.
And when did it occur to you that wine was going to be a part of your life?
After my studies and after my military service, which I didn't finish because I caught a spinal meningitis during the military service.
That must have been very scary.
Very, because at the time, the army, you know, would take care of you when you were almost dying. So I had a very difficult time in hospital for almost a year, and then afterwards I decided to go away, and I came to this country, to United States, and I had some connections, so I worked for a wine importer called Wildman, Frederick Wildman, And then I went to California, worked for a winery over there called Almaden Winery. Almaden at the time was the winery trying to make good wine. I wrote articles for the Revue du Vin de France, who had asked me to write something about California because nobody in France knew that wine was made in California, which gave me the opportunity of a rare encounter with the Bob Mondavi, who at the time was nothing, who had only a vision. And somebody told me, you must meet this person, which I did. And it was really an impressive man at the time, with really a vision for what he wanted to do. And the encounter of people like this, of being closer to the wine business, which I hadn't been before because my family wasn't living in the wine region, gave me the incentive to start working there. And so I wrote my father and his partner, Monsieur Leroy, and asking if I could learn. And they said yes. And so I came back to Burgundy and started to learn what the métier, you know, the practices of vigneron. And so I started from scratch, from the basis. And voilà, and it has been my life since.
Did you meet Paul Masson?
I didn't meet Paul Masson. I think he was dead at the time. He was dead. You know about Paul Masson, there is a wonderful book written about him by a French writer, Jean-François Bazin. Do you know the book?
No.
Oh, well, it's a pity. It's a Jean-François Bazin, who lives in Burgundy, who many people call him Monsieur Bourgogne, because he knows everything about Burgundy, wrote a book about Paul Masson, because Paul Masson came from Burgundy originally.
And so did the Cuttings, I think.
I think he did. And this book is a wonderful book. He tried to have it translated in English, and didn't find a publisher, which is too bad. So this, I take advantage of the occasion to say that it would really be worth translating.
Presumably, you probably met your wife in the States.
I did during a in it was in 68. During a then I had already started to work. And I was working at the time with our friends Leroy to promote our wines here in this country, besides working in the vineyards. And I met her here through friends in New York, yes. And that's how I met her and married her in 71.
So what was it like to learn the métier of being in Burgundy, of being involved with wine?
But you know, when I look back, I consider it as, you know, le bon temps, as we say, the good time. I was very poor, but I had an enormous envy to learn. And for me, I could see how rich it was, how this region was. And, you know, I had the impression also that there was an incredible richness there of history, of potential, and that the mentality of the people was, for some of the growers, a mentality that I could understand, a mentality of artists, people wanting to create something really great. But in many others, you had the impression that they were viticulteurs. You know, viticulteur is a very noble name and occupation, but you know there is a difference between the people cultivating their vines to make wine and to make a great wine if possible, and the people who cultivate their vines only to produce grapes that they will sell to merchants or make wine themselves and sell it to merchants. And there's a big difference of mentality between these two kinds of vignerons.
So DRC has estate bottled from fairly early on. So did you gravitate more towards the sort of person who bottled their own wine? Is that the sort of mentality that sort of spoke to you?
Yes, exactly. When I arrived in Burgundy, I didn't know anybody, and I fortunately met people like Hubert de Monti, like Jacques d'Angerville, like Charles Rousseau, and these people really had the feeling that I was in touch with the people who really understood what Burgundy was, what Burgundy is, and I learned a lot from my contacts with them. So, you know, you asked me at the beginning the question, how is it to start in that? I was trying to gather everything. I was like an aimant, something that I was trying to get everything I could from these people, from my tastings. I tasted in many cellars. I talked with a lot of old vignerons or young ones. It was a moment in life that everybody, I think, has known. It's a moment of life when you are like an aimant. Aimant is something that that attracts iron.
A magnet.
Magnet. Voilà. You are like a magnet that you catch everything, and I was like a magnet trying to catch everything I could, and it is at that time that I was given a task by my father and Mr. Leroy, who were the managers of the domain at the time, which was to gather documentation about the domain, about the wines we were producing, as a documentation to help us in a case that we had against people in France who were selling in Germany wine under the name Remané, so very close to Romané, and it was creating a damage for the domain. So we had a court case there, and this mission that I was given to gather this documentation made me go into the archives in Paris, in Dijon, and I suddenly discovered that what I had read about Burgundy was certainly interesting, but there were much more than that, and I discovered all the letters, all the deed of sales, etc., which were used by Richard Aulnay when he wrote his book about Romane Conti.
Did you provide those to Richard?
Yeah.
I see.
He found things on his own, but I provided him with a lot of the, and we worked together, in fact, on this.
Because it's an incredibly detailed book.
Oui.
About the history of the position.
It was a fascinating work. It was to work with somebody as smart, sensitive, etc., as Richard Aulnay. So it is at that time that I really formed my idea of Burgundy and the way I look at it, my vision, if I can say.
What did someone like Jacques d'Angerville tell you? As I've never met him as
Jacques d'Angerville,
his past.
The one I talked the most with was Hubert de Monti.
I see.
Jacques d'Angerville was more of a father, somebody, the example, you know, more the example than somebody who told me concrete things. But he was
less like of the practical, more of the inspirational.
Voilà, Jacques d'Angerville was somebody who was so much looking for purity in his wines and so straight in his life. You know, so he was really a wonderful example, and it was more like this.
And what did Hubert de Monti tell you?
He told me a lot about his idea about fining, for instance. I just think of that, but about a lot of the know-hows, you know, the savoir-faire that we have in Burgundy, and giving me his opinion about fining, about spraying this, about hacking, about all the things that are questions. you know, because as you know, to make wines and to make great wines, it's very much in the vineyards, but the élevage also is something extremely important, and it's every year like a sort of a white page, and you to be able to speak with somebody who has had the experience of Hubert Monti was an extraordinarily enriching.
When did you first meet Becky Wasserman?
I think it must be in 68 or something like that, with her husband called Bart Wasserman, and who was a great taster, one of the best tasters I've ever met. They arrived in Burgundy as a, it was really a sort of a gift of God, the Wassermans, when they arrived in Burgundy, because they for them, a little like for me, Burgundy was a sort of a heaven, not a heaven with an easy, peaceful life, but heaven because of all what it can offer. And myself and a few other growers, young growers, we had a wonderful time with the Wassermans. And myself, I think I was especially a friend with them. And we were tasting together, traveling also together. It was a great time.
What was France like? I mean, because in Paris in 68, 69, you had a lot of protests. And what was it like in Burgundy in the late 60s?
Oh, but you know, it's in France, it's very much when things happen in Paris, very often nothing happens in France. And I must say, in 68, you know, nothing happened. Frankly, nothing happened. I went to Paris to see a little what was happening, and remember I went to La Sorbonne after the things were finished, and I could just to have a look at. But well, frankly, it didn't leave. Well, I think I have to be short about this because it didn't leave any trace in my neither in my life or in my memory.
Did you ever picture...
Except meeting my wife.
Did you ever picture a métier for yourself that wasn't wine? Was there a period of time when you considered doing something else?
I think I would have liked to be a teacher if I had to choose another profession. But, you know, I must say, when I decided to go into the wine, I dedicated myself totally to it, and... I dived into it, and I never thought of anything else.
What was the condition of the vineyards in Burgundy in the 60s? I mean, I imagine that would have been the dawn of the chemical era, where people were starting to use herbicides.
It was a time we were not so far from after the war, you know, and people were discovering that you could protect your crop from the beginning to the end. To the harvest with these chemical products. You could feed your vines also with chemical that would concentrate, you know, the elements they need. And it was a period where you had, at the same time, this miracle of being able to protect your crop from the beginning to the end completely. At the same time, the market was becoming better, was asking for more wine. France was considered as the only country in the world producing fine wines. So it was a sort of a moment of where everybody is, it's very human, is taken towards productivity. And at that time, it's sure that Burgundy was, everybody was trying to produce as much as the appellation contrôlée would allow. And chaptalization was something that was used widely. The chemical products were also used. It was a period through which I guess we had to go. We had to go through in order to understand what not to do. Voilà. And at the same time, in the 70s, suddenly you had people like Mondavi in California, and the French didn't realize it at the beginning that some other countries were also realizing that the market was becoming good and wanted to give us a how do you say it, a run for our money?
Sure.
And so we didn't realize it at the beginning, and we went on this sort of easy times. And it's only in the middle of the 70s that suddenly we realized that. And one of the things that opened the eyes was this this famous tasting, you know, that where some California wines were tasted better, if I can say.
And you were at that tasting.
I was at the tasting. And I think it is the best thing that could have happened to the French wines and to Burgundy, because we received a kick in the ass. Huh? Not only this tasting, but I take it as a sort of a symbol, but the apparition of these wines, these competitors around the world, made us little by little understand that if we wanted to keep our place, we had to come back to the fundamentals and come back to what Burgundy is made for.
What was your reaction to the wines as they were being poured at that tasting?
Frankly, I don't remember very well because it was a very social event.
I see.
Steven Spurrier had invited a few people whom he knew. I was invited because I had the completely wrong reputation that I knew something about California wines. But it was
because you had been there.
But I had been there 10 years before, and I had not followed at all what happened in California. So I really didn't know. But it was social. And the people were talking, and I remember we had one glass. The wine, we didn't have, you know, all the glasses. We had one glass only, and the wines were poured one after the other. And we didn't know there were California wines.
They never told you.
No, we didn't know there were French wines. I'm sorry.
I see. Voilà, they told you it was a California.
Well,
wine
a California tasting. And so we tasted. And afterwards, Stephen asked for our notes, and he gave a ranking, and then said, you know, these wines are California. They are not French. And for him, I really believe that it was finished. I mean, it was fun event.
A fun day. Wasn't it? Yeah.
But there was this journalist from the New York Times, I think, who was behind and who think, oh, but there is something. This is a scoop, they say, and that's how it this tasting was told about.
And what was the condition of the domain in the 70s? What was it like in the 70s at DRC?
At the domain, it was a we were always we have been always respectful of the soil at the domain. We have been, as I told you, the trend was for chemicals and all, and but we have, for instance, we never used herbicides. Of course, we used pesticides to like everybody, and the yields were certainly at the time more important, suddenly more important than what they should have been, which didn't keep us to make very good wines. And today, I'm very surprised to taste wines of that time, 72s, 73s, 76s even, that are, with time, much better than we considered them at the beginning. And so the terroir speaks always. Huh? And even if the yields were a little higher than they should have been, these wines still carry very well their terroir. And this is something that has been very, very surprising to me, especially recently when I tasted these.
And how should I understand the terroirs of the domain? If I were to think about those different vineyards and the wines they produce, what are some of the keys to understanding each?
It's a very difficult question because what you ask me is to tell you what what makes the personality of this or this terroir on that one. And it is very difficult because in a climat, let's say, if you take a climat like La Tâche, where you have from the top of La Tâche to the bottom, the whole Grand Cru area is covered by La Tâche from top to the bottom. You have different soils, at least five or six different types of soil, so which shows very well that the climat are not only based on their natural conditions, but also are man's construction.
Through the history of time, forming the boundaries.
Exactly. And Romanée-Conti is a quite homogeneous terroir with practically everywhere about the same type of soil. But La Tâche, very, very different. And certainly this complexity of types of soil in La Tâche is the key to the wine it produces. So you have to be very careful. For instance, if we take something like the compost that we put depends of the vineyard, every 2, 3, 4 years, you have to have a different approach depending if you are at the bottom of La Tâche or the top. And because if you put everywhere the same amount, you may have a response that is good from one part and not as good from the other. So you have to be very careful. And one thing is certainly that I have learned is that the least the least you bring to the vineyard, the more chances you have to have in the wine an expression of the true personality of the wine. I don't mean you have to do nothing, but for instance, with the compost, you have to be very gentle. It's important to bring some compost as a nutrient bringing microbial life, not as a fertilizer, but microbial life. And but you have to be very gentle and have different approach depending on what part of the vineyard you deal with. This is my answer to your question on the vignon approach.
So I think, the tendency, at least for me, is to often think, because they're so great, how about Romanée-Conti or La Tâche? But you have other holdings. Do you feel that in those other holdings, one or more than one is kind of overlooked sometimes? Is there one that maybe doesn't get the reputation it deserves from the quality of the wine?
Well, yes. I think, to take an example, in this hierarchy that you have in the Grand Cru of Vosne-Romanée, from Romanée-Conti, La Tâche, Richebourg, Romanée-Saint-Vivant, Richebourg-Romanée-Saint-Vivant being about on the same level, and then on Flagey-Echezeau, Grands-Echezeau, and Echezeau, you have a wine that is, in my opinion, a very great wine, is the Grands-Echezeau. The Grands-Echezeau, which has the name Echezeau, and is separated from the Echezeau only by a small path, but where the soil is very different from the Echezeau, where the Echezeau, you have a shallow soil, the rock is very close to the surface, you dig up rock very often when you plow, and in the Grands-Echezeau, much deeper soil, and much with more clay. And the two wines are very different. And second, the Grands-Echezeau, in my opinion, is much closer to La Tâche, for instance, than it is to the Echezeau. And the Grands-Echezeau, with its name Echezeau, because he has the name Echezeau, I think it's more grand than Echezeau. Voilà, it's more grand than Echezeau. And it's a wine that should deserve maybe a higher ranking that it has in reality.
What about some of the other vineyards? What would you say the characteristics of Richebourg are?
Well, of course, they depend of the vintage. But every year, especially with time, you have in the Richebourg a character which is unique and which is very different from Romanée-Conti, where you have this, because it doesn't have this silky a very silky character in the mouth, and very different from Romani Saint-Vivant, where it doesn't have the very fine bouquet of Saint-Vivant, which is very close to the Romani Conti. It has a personality that is very much oriented towards muscles. It's a personality that is always the Richebourg. It's not a wine where you find some questions about if God exists, you know, or it's a wine that is very terre à terre, you know, feet on the ground. And I very easily see it as a sort of the bodyguard of Romani Conti, you know, just sitting there, looking, being close to Romani Conti, protecting it, and voilà, the sort of bodyguard. But you know, those impressions about the wine are things that can be that are very personal. What you would like we find out, if we can, today, is to find what makes the personality of Richebourg. It's obviously because you are on the slope. It is on the slope on the same level as Romani Conti, plus about one third above the Romani Conti, against La Romanée, in fact. Hein? One-third is against La Romanée. And what you realize is that the combination of this lower part and this upper part makes a very different wine from Romani Conti, where you don't have the very fine bouquet. You have something more immediate in the nose, more powerful, less fine, and in the mouth also more powerful than Romani Conti, and without this very thin texture that you have. So this certainly explains itself by the situation on the slope, and it shows also well that the best situation on the slope is obviously what we call the Piémont, which is the palm of the slope, you know, at the bottom of the bottom of the slope, where Romani Conti is by itself. La Tâche takes the whole Grand Cru area, bottom to top. Richebourg takes it from the middle, but also the top. Romani Saint-Vivant, the bottom, and you have the Romani Conti there in the middle, who is just at the ideal position to make the greatest wine.
There's been some revitalization of the vines in Romani Saint-Vivant in recent years, and what prompted those, and how did you go about it?
But you know, this is something that I think all growers go through. The Romani Saint-Vivant that we were given, the Romani Saint-Vivant in '66. And we became owners of it in '88, and it made during all these years very good wine, very interesting wine. And but I was always shocked by, in the mouth, a certain rudeness. Voilà, a certain rudeness. And I thought that it was not really part of the. I wished to take it away from this Grand Cru. And so we vinified by parcels, what you call blocks, by parcels, choosing to vinify apart two parcels that we thought were perhaps where this thing was coming from. And so we did this, we did it for several years, and it came out that yes, one of these parcels was a very old vines, so normally should have given great wines, but in fact these very old vines were not very fine, and so the sort of harshness was coming partly from this and partly from another vineyard, and for the same reasons. And so we tried to circumvent this by pruning differently, putting weeds, how do you say that, herb.
Oh, cover crop.
Cover crop, yeah. And for several years, and it didn't change anything. They were still vinified separately and not coming anymore into the bottle. So for a number of years, we made Romanée Saint-Vivant with only 3 hectares out of the 3 hectares and a half out of the 5 and more that we had. So we decided to tear it out. And at the same time, what was decided me to do that was that at the same time we were developing very nicely the our selection of fine types of Pinot. You know, since now I think 35 years, we have been selecting in our old vineyards. Especially in the ones that had been replanted with graftings taken from the old Romanée Conti before it was torn out in 45. So to try to save some of these very fine types of Pinot. And we finally happened to have around 25-30, we'd say lignée clones of ours, which were really fine, and which we could use for replantation. So we tore out these two parcels of little by little, not in at once, but little by little, these two parcels of Romanée Saint-Vivant, and replanted them. And the last one had been replanted last year. So I hope. Alors, these new vineyards are picked apart and will, for some years, be vinified as Rhône Romanée Premier Cru, but I hope, because of the quality of the vines that have been used, that in maybe 4 or 5 years we are able to put them in the Romanée Saint-Vivant. And I should have said at first, it is that once these parcels were put aside, our Romanée Saint-Vivant took a very different texture and much closer to what they wanted.
More like Romanée Conti, I think.
Voilà,
silkier
and more corresponding to what you expect from a grand cru like Romanée Saint-Vivant, which has, by essence, a feminine character.
You've done a number of experiments over the years with different kinds of vinification, just to see what the results would be, a small batch, and, you know, not for release, but just to see what would happen. And what have been some of the findings and results of those numerous experiments with the different vineyards that you have and different vinification techniques?
The experiments is something we have done all the time. We have done and we still do experiments. The destemming or keeping the stems, destemming is something, yes, that is always a question. It's not so much a question for us anymore. We experimented a number of times with very small batches on 100% stems, 0% stems in a sunny year, in a rainy year. And it's very obvious that in a sunny year, when you have a phenolic maturity that is very good, then you can keep the stems. And I think the stems bring really a potential to the wine, especially a potential for aging. If you have a rainy year when the maturity was reached at the very end, and the stems and the skins that don't have a very complete phenolic maturity, then it's important to take off some of the stems. Because, again, when you make experiments in a year like this, with 100%, 0%, you see very easily that the answer is in the middle, more or less in the middle, which makes me say that it's one of the rules we have in Burgundy, that the solution is most of the time in the middle, never in the extremes, never in the extremes. So it's something that we have really experimented enough to know more or less how much stems to take off or to keep them entirely. It's not a big problem. And there was a sort of a legend about the domain saying that we don't destem, which is wrong. We don't destem when we think we don't have to destem, and we destem when we think we have to. And I think to keep a good part of the stems, even in a difficult year, in a rainy year, with less maturity, is something important, because what is brought to the wine by these stems are precursors, as we say, precursors of the very fine bouquets, fine perfumes that you have in the wine when it takes time. These, what I call, other people can call them differently, what I call rose petal character, very delicate rose, fading rose petal, you know, very, very delicate character. And this, in my opinion, is enhanced by keeping some of the stems.
And what about cold maceration? Do you do some of that?
No. No, never cold maceration. If we have a vintage, when the grapes arrive in the winery warm, let's say it can vary in the afternoon, it can very well arrive at 25 degrees, then we will try to lower the temperature as much as we can, take it back, if we can, around 16, 17, maximum, so that the fermentation doesn't start immediately, but takes a few days to start. And if it is very cold, and for instance, I remember, when was it, in 2012 or 11, we had to warm up a little the grapes, because they came in at 10, 12, 13 degrees, so the fermentation was not starting, so we helped it by heating the slightly to 15, which is the temperature when the fermentation starts. But cold maceration, I don't believe in cold maceration. Every technique, in my opinion, which will extract more than what is naturally extracted by a natural fermentation is bad. As this is really our experience at the domain. Everything that is where you try to go further than what nature will do, it's always a mistake.
Do you ever flambé the wood? Do you ever start a fire in the fermenting tank before you put the grapes in?
Oh, oui, but this is an old... it has no influence of any kind on the winemaking. It is just a way to disinfect the because you know the vats are the wooden vats. We vinify in wooden vats. They are cleaned with water and dried as much as possible. But technique of putting some mar and lighting it and having the alcohol of the mar burn is a way to aseptize the tank.
Because sometimes when I've tried Romani Conti wines very young, I almost had a mouth-numbing sensation, like on my tongue, like a little bit of a numbing sensation at the very young wines from barrel. And I wondered if it might have been a little slight hint of char. You know.
Oh, no. No, because there is no char. There is no char at all. It's when you see the vat after this burning of the there is no. You have nothing left. Huh? It's all gone, and the wood itself is not attacked at all.
And what about the wood? Is it Francois Frère and Raymond?
You mean the wood of the barrels?
Yes, sir.
The wood of the vats, it's different. It's not important. Now, the wood of the vats, it's not important. I mean, the vat is a content. For the barrels, a bad experience that we had many years ago with our tonnelier made us choose to buy the wood ourselves, the merin, to buy ourselves, to ask our tonnelier, François, to store the merin at a special place in his Saint-Romain, where it's very windy and in good situation to be outside. And we ask him to use this wood for our barrels. So we have all the time the wood necessary for, let's say, 3, 4, 5 years of barrel making being in storage over there. And every year he makes a certain number, the number of barrels we need from this wood. And we use wood that has been aged 3 years and 4 years. We tried 5 years, but it was not interesting.
And François Frère makes the barrels out of that wood.
Yes. We use also a few barrels every year to keep François and his stores also. We use a few barrels from Tarenceau, from other cooperage.
What about the Noblet family? They've worked a long time, a couple of different generations at the domain. What have you learned from them? What has it been like working with them?
Oh, but the Noblets are part of the domain. They are really they belong to the domain. If we take Bernard Noblet, who is our cellar master right now, his grandfather started to work at the domain before marrying a woman who owned vineyard and who started his own domain, but he worked at the domain. And then André Noblet, Bernard's father, was an extraordinary vigneron, extraordinary winemaker, who really was important in the reputation that the domain gained after the Second World War. And today Bernard, who has received some things from his father, but also has really worked on his own and has worked with me, we worked together to go further. Bernard is also somebody who is essential for the domain. And his sister has been working in our office for all her life. The Noblets are the salt of the domain, if I can say.
And what about the addition of a sorting table? When did that happen? Was it a little earlier than other estates?
I don't think we were the first ones to have a sorting table, but I remember the vintage 76, when we very large, I mean quite large vintage. And finally, as we picked late, not very nice grapes, because the rain arrived before it was a very, very dry year, 76, very warm and dry. The rain arrived, we picked after the rain, and the grapes were not so nice not very healthy. And that was the last year when we harvested in Ballonge, and with no sorting. So no sorting at the winery. Sorting was done
in the vineyard,
but not in the winery. And I remember Laloubise and myself, we thought that it was really a pity to do that. We really had to find a way to be able to sort. And we, at the time, there was no sorting table. From later, I learned that a few other people had tried, but we worked with an industrialist from Le Creusot, who built a sorting table for us. It was a big thing. This man was building big vats. I mean, his trade was to make big vats for industry. And so he built for us a big sorting table. And the first vintage was 77. And then after that, I think we had another one that was more easy to use. And now we have one, I think, that couldn't be much better than it is. But it's something that has brought a lot to our to the quality of the grapes we put in the vat, but it's also something that has learned to us that the most important sorting is at the vineyard. That if you count on your sorting table in the winery to sort your grapes in a year of with botrytis, you are wrong. The most important is in the vineyard. The sorting on the sorting table must only be a fine tuning. It's only if it is a fine tuning that you will have in your vat the grapes as you want them to be.
And speaking of the vineyard again, I mean, Claude Bourgognon consults with you and has consulted for a number of years. What is the experience that you've learned from him? What is the advice you've taken?
Claude Bourguignon has been a door. Certainly, he has opened doors for us, especially in the knowledge of the soil. Before Claude Bourguignon, we had no idea that of the importance of the clay, for instance. How important it was to respect this clay with these internal surfaces, you know, that are with these the clay is something that is extremely easy to shut down, and this is the most important thing that Claude taught us is the respect of the soil. I mean, to a confirmation that if we don't try to find ways not to compact the soil, if we don't find ways not to give life to the to all the bacteria, microbes, and worms, etc., all this life in the soil, we will not reach our goal. So this has been very important.
And you had special tractors designed so that you wouldn't compact the soil.
Alors, this is something that is both something that came from the teaching of Claude Bourguignon, but also from the use of the horse. Because I decided, I don't remember exactly when, I decided to use a horse because it compacts much less than a big tractor. And so we did, and by doing so, you would have realized also that at the same time, if you use a horse not too compact, it would be ridiculous to afterwards to come with a big tractor to spray, you know, to treat the. So we had to find light tractors. So we did find light tractors, but they broke all the time. So we had a builder who designed a tractor for us that was light, and this was very important. And the horse was for us something important, not so much because of the horse itself, even if it is very nice to have a horse working in the vineyard because it doesn't compact, but and it is beautiful to see. Sometimes when people tell me, "But why do you have a horse? It's folklore, you know." And I say, "No, it's not." I try to explain why it's not folklore, and finally, if they are insistent, I say, "But we have a horse because it's beautiful," And it's true. It's to watch a horse working in a vineyard. It's something. It's like a work of art. It's beauty. It's a beautiful thing. And what we learned from that is that you cannot have a horse and then have a big tractor. So we had this light tractor. We had to find this light tractor, and we found some that were that broke all the time. So we had our own tractor built for us by a builder who started it as a tractor that he built in many. Examples for other people. We are using now these lighter tractors for all our vineyards, not only where the horse is. So the lesson for us of the horse has been certainly it's interesting to have a horse, but it's the light tractors that he made us start with was the most important.
And you make some wines that you don't commercialize, Batard Montrachet and wines from the Oak Coat, that from vineyards that you got from the Morimange. What are those wines like?
The Batard is a wine we make one barrel every year of Batard. And I think all the people who had the occasion to taste it at the Domaine only, because this is, for a few occasions, we have had the Batard drunk in outside of the Domaine, but usually it's drunk at the Domaine, and it makes a wine that I think is at the level of Montrachet, because it comes from a very old vineyard, something like 100 years old, producing small clusters, golden berries. You put that on the pressoir. Comes out a juice that is beautiful, and it's a wine that makes itself. I mean, you have nothing to do, and it's in my opinion a great white wine. But it's not on the market. But I don't think you can make many greater wines than this in Burgundy, and the wine the Haute Côte. It's a vineyard that we inherited, if I can say, with the monastery of Saint-Vivant when we bought it in the 90s, and it makes a wine that is good. I think a nice haute côte, and which we drink also. It's sold. We have it sold. By two merchants and two friends. Voilà. But it's a nice wine, but nothing, you know, the terroir is not one of the best of the Haute Côte, and it makes a nice wine.
When you were given the title of co-gérant and then gérant in charge of DRC, what were your feelings and what were your goals? What did you want to achieve?
I remember it happened at the same time as we had a fascinating tasting for the book by Richard Olney of all the Romani Contis we had at the Domaine. For me, it was the first time I was doing this. We had so few Romani Conti from before the Phylloxera, you know, before 1945, that they were sacred bottles. We would never taste them. And this tasting made me discover wines that were very old, but not old to taste, not young either, but had a sort of a something eternal, a sort of a serenity. Wines where the impression was that all the flesh, all what was gone, and the wines were all spirit. And you know, when a wine is like this, a spirit, you have the impression that it can last for forever. And this was the first time for me to taste wines like this. So for me, it became what you call in, I think it's not a nice word, but benchmark, you know. And so when I was named co-gérant and when I took the responsibility after 91, well, my goal was to try to make wines like this, hein, and to put all our effort and do everything we could at all levels to make wines of that caliber. And do we make wines of this caliber today? I don't know, but we try to.
What is the next step at the Domaine over the next 30 years? What is the next challenge? You've recently taken responsibility for vineyards in Corton. You have revitalized not just Romani Saint-Vivant, but soil in a number of your vineyards. You're the benchmark wine of the world at this time. Are there future challenges for the Domaine still to be met?
The Corton challenge was something that I'm very pleased we did, because since some time I wanted the Domaine to have a challenge that would be not only the challenge of making great wines every year, but also something that would oblige us to have imagination, to think of other things that only the main wines. And Corton was useful for this. It was a very interesting challenge that is not at all finished, because now we have more or less understood the vineyards, and we have started to take the steps to replant some, to tibad some others, towards what will be in some years a vinification by climat and not anymore as a Corton. Although I wonder if what we do today with a Corton with three climats is perhaps the answer. This I'm not sure about. But the challenges for the future, I think it's really a challenge to keep our philosophy the way it is. And you know, everything is done by people. The Domaine, it's vineyards, but it's also an entreprise, a company. It's a team. And this team has to keep that philosophy you need to have to make great wines, because to make great wines is an addition of details. And the way one will sweep the courtyard, I wouldn't say is as important as some other things, but everything is important. Everybody has to have in their mind that we want to make great wines. We have a team which has this philosophy right now, but it's something fragile. I know how difficult it is to keep this envy, this dynamism, for me, the challenge for the future, it's that, just that, to keep this momentum we have in our team.
Aubert Duvalain, he wanted to be a teacher, and he defines greatness as the building of a team. Thank you very much for being here today. Aubert Duvalain of Domaine de la Romanée-Conti. Thank you very much.
Philly Wine Week 2015 is coming up soon. From March 22nd through March 29th, the city of Philadelphia will be playing host to winemakers, importers, wine writers, and even a podcast host or two. Everyone celebrating the excellent wine, food, and vibe at some of Philly's best restaurants. There'll be a number of wine dinners, trade tastings, seminars, late-night parties, and special happy hours, and one of those is going to feature, that's right, yours truly, discussing the lesser-known grape varieties of the Piemonte on Friday, March 27th at A Kitchen. We'll be drinking and discussing Timorosso, Ruque, Pellaverga, and more, so you know that's going to be a good time. There's going to be a lot of great hosted events. Go to phillywineweek.org. Again, phillywineweek.org for a full event listing. There's going to be a grand celebration, and I hope to see you there for Philly Wine Week starting March 22nd in Philadelphia. Cheers.
That was our show. If you're curious about what we're up to in the future, check us out on Facebook. Give us a like, and you'll see all our fancy posts. It's I'll Drink to That, Talking Wine with Levy Dalton is a Facebook fan page. Hey, fan page. Yeah. We're on Twitter at Drink to That Pod. And we're also up on Instagram. Some pretty artistic shots sometimes. Sometimes not. Sometimes good, though. At Levy Opens Wine. And then I got to tell you, we're also got our own website there. It's alldrinktothatpod.com, where you can stream stuff off of it or download direct episodes so you don't have to go through iTunes if you don't want to. We like to give options. We're about options here. So lots to do, lots to think about. Maybe you want a t-shirt. Maybe you like a fancy, well, they're not that fancy, but they're pretty cool. I'll Drink to That t-shirt of your very own in a variety of different colors, shapes, sizes, onesies even. I mean, you can get onesies, you can get tanks, you can get biker tanks, you can get tees, you can get other stuff, hoodies, for God's sakes. It's all up there. You can find the information up on our website if you'd like to check it out and wear what you hear. And then there's also that possibility you could shoot us some real support. Shoot us a little dough. Help keep the microphones rolling. We are here because of dedication, because of love, because of interest. But we're also here because we make the finances work, and we could always use a little help with that. Thanks for your consideration.